You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, July 6th, 2013.
It is July 5th.
July 5th. 2013. It's Friday, July, early July 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Today is a taped program, so it's super casual. Sadly, we have allowed Cliff Schecter to take a day with his family, released him from his rigorous once-a-week appearance on The Majority Report. Matt right now is probably, well, if I know Matt, he's probably sitting in front of the computer as he has been since the moment he left the office and got back to his house, and has been there for the last 48 hours, either updating his Tumblr blog or, you know, searching for wrestling paraphernalia on eBay.
I was also just watching the Twilight Zone July 4th marathon.
There you go. And Michael, I'm sure, is sitting around with a glass of Chablis, hanging with his other pro-establishment friends, talking about how a wonderful moules frites he had yesterday to celebrate 4th of July.
Some meditation could help. Exactly. Better.
Just gotten up from an hour and a half low intensity yoga session. Being as anti-American and effete as he possibly can be. And meanwhile, I, no doubt, am sitting around either, doing chores for Nikki or picking up something for Mila or trying to shush Saul. I'm exhausted.
Matt and I are both having more fun.
I am, there's no doubt in my mind, all I'm doing is thinking about what was my life like back before I had a family on 4th of July or July 5th. But that's not why, that's not what I'm here to tell you, folks. I'm here to tell you that we have two interviews for you that I did at Netroots Nation 2013, a week and a half ago or so, 2 weeks ago. One is with former Congressman Barney Frank. In it, we talk about his push to cut military spending. I talk about whether or not he has regrets about Dodd-Frank, that they left a little bit too much up for regulators, and also about what he had to say regarding President Obama's willingness, or President-elect Obama's willingness, to provide foreclosure relief directly to mortgage holders. Ground that's been covered by other people, but I wanted to see if I could get something new. I don't know that I did, maybe a little bit. It depends on how closely you've been reading these things. But I think I teased out, it's more than I've seen in any other interview with him regarding particularly the helping mortgage holders directly. And so I hope you enjoy it. I'm generally not a fan of interviewing politicians, but he's no longer a politician. Was hoping for a little more frankness than we could get, and I think we got some. And then the great Shannon Moore from Alaska She is the premier liberal talker in the state of Alaska, and she has been engaged in a fight that we actually interviewed about Netroots Nation 2012 regarding Pebble Beach. And this is a fight that she's been heavily engaged in, and it's important to all of us in many respects because apparently a huge source of our fish, the entire source of our fish in the country comes from this one bay. Just this week, David Vitter basically took off his diapers and accused environmental groups of bribing supporters into commenting on a federal environmental study by offering them a free chance to win free fishing trip. There's been a lot of statements, Shannon will talk about it on the interview. People are sending in comments to the EPA, and supposedly, if you tell a friend about that these comments period is open, you could win a trip to go fishing, I think, with Shannon. And he's saying this is a bribe. The group is called Trout Unlimited. And it encourages visitors to its website to comment on the proposed environmental, the EPA draft. Contemplate this for a moment, folks. Who are the people going to these, you know, to Trout Unlimited? Who are the people who are going to these websites? They want to take action. This is simply a way of publicizing it. And, you know, it's just, it's stunning that David Vitter is weighing in this way. But, you know, you can imagine how much David Vitter is in the pockets of those energy companies who want to drill there. So, and those mining companies who want to basically strip the hell out of this area. So, Barney Frank, Shannon Moore, we will be back Monday with a live show. Matt and Mike will be joining us. I hope you're having a great 4th. If you have the day off, you're very fortunate. If you don't, I hope this makes your day a little bit better. All right, folks. See you on Monday/Tuesday. I'm going to tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us, this one. Joining me now at Netroots Nation 2013, former Congressman Barney Frank from Massachusetts. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
You're here at Netroots Nation to talk about the work that you did in and that you're continuing to pursue, obviously, on cutting the budget of the Pentagon.
It is the single most important issue. I've become somewhat obsessive about it. We have a serious deficit. It should not be addressed immediately. Short term, we are still dealing with an unemployment situation, but over time we ought to be bringing it down, not to zero. There's no economic equivalence between a family and a country, but we should reduce it. We are in a fortunate position. We are so overextended and are overspending so much on the military that we can make serious cuts there without having to sacrifice. That doesn't mean we can get everything we want everywhere else. But America is so greatly overextended in military spending. Look, what happened was this. We never had much military spending as a country until the Nazis came. And we built it up for the Nazis and the communists. I mean, we did for World War I temporarily. For 50 years, from 1940 to 1990, there were bad people out there we had to deal with. When the Soviet Union collapsed and the communist empire ended, Both George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton began a substantial reduction in the military. That's one of the reasons Bill Clinton was able to balance the budget without cuts that were too deep in social programs, although I think he cut deeper than he should have. What then happened was 9/11 comes, and the neoconservatives in the Bush administration, Cheney, Wolfowitz, etc., with George Bush's acquiescence, build up the terrorists as if they were as big a threat as the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War. They're bad people. I want to kill them. I don't want them to run loose. But they're not a threat to our national existence. You don't defeat terrorists with nuclear submarines. I wish you did, because we got a lot, they got none. It would be over. What we need to do now is scale back. And what's happened is we have people, one, artificially inflating the threat, and two, persisting in this view that it is somehow America's mission, opportunity, duty to police the world. And the answer is, one, it is not compelled by our interest. Two, it is not something that can easily be squared with our values in every case. But most importantly, it's beyond our capacity. It's beyond our fiscal capacity, and it's beyond our ability to do it. I wish Sudan and South Sudan got along better. I wish Somalia was a coherent society. But the American military can't fix that.
And it's not, I mean, to a large extent, the size of our military budget is not necessarily a function of our military needs, but rather sort of a self-licking ice cream cone, if you will, that has built up over time, right? I mean, am I mistaken?
No question. Well, but except it was going down. Look, there are two aspects to this, and you're right. When things are in place, there's a tendency for them to stay in place because they make money. But you can bring them down over time. It's hard to pull the plug on an existing weapon system. But politically, it's easier not to get into a new weapon system. And George Bush the First and Bill Clinton, even with the first Iraq war and even with Serbia, were bringing the military budget down. And then there was this enormous ramp up, first of all, with two wars, but even the non-war part of the military budget went way up. And there was this view, and look, it's very important right now because President Obama, I was a little critical. He talked about America being the indispensable nation, which basically meant we had to go everywhere and fix things. And we can't. You know, if we could make Afghanistan a less corrupt society, if we could make the Shia and the Sunni in Iraq love each other, maybe we would be morally obligated to try, but we can't do it. And we just get overextended, and the president is now on the right side. I think the most critical question today is the need to support President Obama against his pressure to go into Syria. And I don't like Assad. I wish he wasn't there. But I don't understand what America can do about it. I don't understand how we can bring about an end to that. And all that will happen is we will spend a lot of money and get a lot of people angry, and it'll be no better.
Do you think that there is common cause to be made with those elements of the Republican Party that at least rhetorically are you know, speaking as isolationists on some level? I mean,
definitely. We should be very clear that we're not isolationists. You know, I want to spend some small percentage of the money we're saving in the military on fighting AIDS and malaria overseas and feeding hungry children. And I think properly done, we can be supportive of the international financial institutions. But a very small percentage of the hundreds of billions we spend on the military would go a long way there. But I have, in fact, worked with many of these conservatives. But one of the most encouraging things is this. When sequestration came in, and I believe that you can easily cut the military budget by more than sequestration calls for, although I don't like the way they're doing it, which is why I voted against it. I don't think you should be doing it across the board. But what happened was this. The pro-military Republicans said, we're going to exempt the military from sequestration. If you go back 6 months ago, people thought that might happen.
Right.
And the right wing said no. So the only thing they exempted from sequestration was air controllers. And I think that's been a very good sign. And in fact, in all my years there, only once on the floor of the House did the House vote to reduce the military budget from what the committees on the military had recommended. And it was an amendment that I co-sponsored, and my main sponsor was Mick Mulvaney, a Tea Party Republican from South Carolina. And yes, there is common cause there. We ought to be clear. We're not isolationists, but they... And there are two aspects of this. First of all, it's money being spent that we can't afford. But two, and it's a lot of the mainstream conservatives, the Lindsey Grahams, John McCain's, they're being very inconsistent because domestically, they don't think the government can do much right about the environment. They don't think the government can do much about poverty, about hunger. But when it comes to international, all of a sudden the American government can transform Iraq. The American government can create a coherent society in Somalia. And the right wing understands, some of them, the limitations, not just financially, but on this overreach. Here's the way I think that we have a wonderful military. And they are very good at doing what a military can do. They can stop bad things from happening, but they can't make good things happen. And that's what the right wing also understands.
And basically what you're saying is that to cut the military budget, it almost is, you're almost doing it by attrition in the same way that you just would not rehire.
Absolutely. The military turns over, the average enlistment is 6 years. I wouldn't fire any young person who volunteered. We have them an obligation to them. There were some weapons we're doing now I wish we weren't doing, but we can slow down on the new ones. Then the other thing is this, a lot of what we spend unnecessarily, we spend overseas. We are still defending Western Europe against Stalin. I mean, Western Europe is no longer the weak set of nations it was after World War II. Stalin's dead. The only thing that hasn't changed is we're still there defending them. We still have three ways of dropping thermonuclear weapons on the Soviet Union that doesn't exist anymore. And here, the best way to look at this is look at the other arguments. On the day after the election, 2012, I like to read the conservative papers on days when we've won. And so in the op-ed column of the Wall Street Journal, two defense advocates, one a Bush guy, another guy in the Air Force interview, said, we have a serious problem because the American Air Force is being penalized by its success. Actually, they shouldn't have just said the Air Force, because the American Air Force, the U.S. Air Force, is the largest air force in the world. The second largest air force in the world is, of course, the Navy. They said, here's the problem with American air power. It's the victim of its own success. They said the last time an American was injured by an enemy aircraft in battle was 1953, almost 60 years ago. In every military encounter since then where we have been involved, America has had complete domination of the airspace. And then they said, because of that, because no American has been injured in 60 years, because we completely dominate the airspace, some people don't think we have to expand the Air Force. Yeah, the answer would be, yeah. And they said, no, but we have to expand the Air Force because America must be ready to respond to any trouble anywhere in the world, anytime, any place. And we can't do it. We can't afford it. It's not in our interest. What you have is this, they come up with reasons. They really want America. They want to feel good about our being the power. They get it backwards. But one of the arguments is, well, the president's wrong. We have to have a bigger Navy. Mitt Romney went after him on that. And one encouraging thing is that Barack Obama is the first Democratic presidential candidate to stand up for a lesser military than his Republican opponent. You know, all the Democratic candidates were told you got to be tough. That's why Mike Dukakis was wearing that silly helmet. And Romney lost on that ground. And the one argument is, well, we have to protect the sea lanes. We have to keep open the sea lanes for trade between America and China. Now, what happens over those sea lanes?
Pirates.
China makes about $400 billion a year. Why in the world would the Chinese want to shut it down? It's like saying that Domino's wants to tear up the streets so they can't deliver pizza.
Right. Right. Talking to Congressman Barney Frank, former congressman from Massachusetts. So, Congressman, all right, there's a couple of questions I've been wanting to ask you actually for an extended period of time. We haven't spoken since my days on Air America, in fact. But one of the things that just, you know, changing topics a bit, one of the things that I read in interviews, at least one interview that you gave upon your retirement from the House, regarding TARP, and I imagine you know these are bygone conversations, but very important stuff. One of the things that you had talked about in this New York Magazine interview was in the second go round with TARP that you had had conversations with Henry Paulson regarding providing mortgage relief directly to mortgage holders, and Henry Paulson said, if you can get me the second chunk of TARP money, then I'm willing to do that if the incoming Obama people sign off on it. And you said that they wouldn't do it.
Yeah, it's a problem with the interregnum. People who are historians will remember this is a terrible problem between Franklin Roosevelt and Herbert Hoover. And in fact, we amended the Constitution, not me, older people. The new president used to take office March 4th. They moved it back to January 20th, but we still had too much of an interregnum. Yeah, I asked the Obama people to do it, and it now turns out Nancy Pelosi wasn't sure we could have gotten it through, but what we needed, if Paulson requested it, the way it worked is that money would be spent unless Congress voted to cancel it, but the president could have vetoed that, so it would have worked. But he said, I'm not going to do that. It's now like December, without Obama saying it's okay. And I asked the Obama administration, the incoming, and they said, well, we're not in power. He can do it if he wants to. It's what Roosevelt said to Hoover. If you want to do it, you do it. I'm not going to take responsibility until I'm in charge. And I understood in part what they were saying. We don't want to be held accountable because we're not administering. But I was frustrated with both of them. And in fact, Obama said at that point, well, we only have one president at a time. And my response was that overstated the number of presidents we then had. And that was a lost opportunity. I was very frustrated.
So do you attribute that to a process? I mean, was it just a simply a notion of process, or was it just simply not their policy?
No, I don't think it was not their policy, in fairness. Paulson was somewhat reluctant, but basically what happened was this. When we were voting on the TARP, Paulson said, can I have the money? And I think highly of Paulson. We've worked together. But he was thinking only of what was needed to keep the financial community from falling apart. We said you need two things. You need some limitations on compensation, and you need to do something about mortgage relief. He was reluctant, but we said, no bill if you don't do that. We're writing the bill. So we wrote into the bill the requirement of mortgage relief. And the New York Times had an editorial quoting me. I waved at him, the bill, literally, the angriest confrontation I had with him when he said, I don't have the authority. Showed him he did. So he was reluctant, but finally I was able to say to him, you promised me, and we put it in the bill, and you owe this to those who voted for it. On the Obama side, they basically felt, and it wasn't just on this one, and it's what every incoming president says, don't tie my hands. You know, and they both had an argument. Paulson said, I don't want to take this responsibility and lock in the Obama people. Obama said, I'm not in charge. I don't want to be held accountable for spending money when I have no control. So I think it was risk aversion on both sides.
He was perfectly willing to tie the hands in regards to bailing out the banks.
Well, no, Obama supported that. He was, on the first chunk, it was on the second chunk that, he was reluctant to use the authority. Well, I take it back. His view was it was important to keep the economy from melting down totally, to get the money out right away. That's why he wanted the first amount without that. When we saw that he was doing that without it, we yelled and screamed, and then we got him to commit to doing it with the second amount, and Obama said, I'm not going to get involved before I'm involved. And Obama's position was, if Paulson wants to do that, he can do it. He has the authority, or Bush, rather.
Right, and Bush was
in Texas.
Right.
I mean, we had a meeting in September or October, which McCain forced, and Bush was presiding, Cheney, and Democratic and Republican leadership of the House and the Senate, the Financial Services Committee, and Bush was sitting there, and somebody said to somebody else, "We got to look at him, he's in Texas already." He was like staring at the ceiling.
Well, he's probably contemplating some of his artwork that he was going to be doing.
He did say at one point when McCain was showing a really irresponsible, he forced the meeting, he wouldn't say what he thought. I am told that Bush said to Nancy Pelosi, I told you were going to miss me with regard to McCain.
So, I mean, is there not, let me, I mean, just, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but is there not some measure of inconsistency with President Obama being supportive of the first chunk when he's not president, but not being willing to sort of endorse the spending of the authorized second chunk?
Well, don't you act like I'm supposed to defend this. I'm the one who brought it out. I'm the one who was criticizing him, of course. I'm the one who said we have no president. Yes, I'm critical of both of them.
Fair enough.
But I would have thought that was clear. And when I say you've overstated the number of presidents we have. That's hardly an endorsement of the way they were behaving.
Right.
To say that they're both abdicating responsibility.
Right. And so let me also turn to another thing. One of the signature pieces of legislation that you passed, of course, in certainly within the past couple of years, was Dodd-Frank. It's been now a couple of years where the much of the building of that regulatory framework has been taken up by regulators, and or regulators have been prevented in a myriad of different ways of implementing those regulations. When you look back on that legislation now, do you have a sense that perhaps there was too much latitude for regulators there, because not so much that regulators couldn't handle it, but that those who would influence regulators would inhibit the regulators' ability?
Not at all. First of all, I would ask people who say that. It's inherent in the nature of this. One of the questions is, what's an adequate capital ratio for banks? You can't put a number down in 2010 and have that be good forever. A lot of these things have to be adjusted. Look at, in terms of specifics, we were much more specific than the New Deal legislation. The people on the other end have said, well, it was too big. Well, was it too big or too small? In fact, I would say two things. First of all, nothing bad has happened that should not have happened because they haven't yet implemented it. Secondly, they've done a better job of implementing than people think. The media obviously likes to take the negative side. There was just an article again in the Wall Street Journal noting that most derivative transactions are now being done on exchanges, a major thing that we wanted to do. Third, and here was the biggest mistake, nothing we could control, the Republicans took over the House. And when the Republicans took over the House, they reduced the funding, even though the Democrats tried to push it up from the Senate, but it's a 50-50. The two agencies that got the most authority under that bill were the Securities and Exchange Commission and Commodities Futures Trading Commission, which got control over derivatives. The Republicans have refused to give them the money with which they can do it. Secondly, and it's like a double bind, you know, the president is now pushing hard to get judges confirmed for the District of Columbia Circuit Court.
Right.
That conservative court is the one to which all lawsuits over regulations go. That court has held back the pace of the regulations. And so what they get the SEC and the CFTC in a double bind. First, the Republicans don't give them enough money. Secondly, the courts tell them they got to do a lot more analysis before they can promulgate the regulation. And so that's what happened.
And then the third element, I guess, is the lawyer, the attorneys for
the financial people, which flood them with paper. You're exactly right. I left that out. But it's still moving ahead. The Volcker rule will be done by the end of the year. There is one area where I'm worried, but here, frankly, it's the liberals as bad as the conservatives, and that's, I think the single biggest problem we had to deal with was people making loans and then not being the one who got repaid. Securitization.
Right.
I lend a bunch of people money and I sell the loan. So we put in there that if you're going to be the one who takes those loans and sells them as a security, you take the first 5% of the losses. Now, to get the bill through, we had to make a potential exception for very, very good mortgage loans. Senator Landrieu wanted it. Chris said, I need the 60 votes. What you now have are some of the low-income groups and some of the housing builders trying to say that, in effect, for most residential mortgages, there shouldn't be risk retention. I just co-signed an article with Sheila Bair, the former of the FDIC, pushing on that. That's the only one I can see where there's a threat to weaken it. But I have to say, unfortunately, some of the liberals are joining in with some of the conservatives in trying to do that.
Why is that?
Because they say they want low-income people, they want middle-income people to own homes. And they say people can't afford a down payment. Well, I believe that liberals and conservatives both have overblown home ownership for lower-income people.
The value of it.
We should be providing decent, good, affordable rental housing. But putting people into home ownership, there's no great economic advantages from them. They don't get a tax break because they don't itemize. And that's the argument. Oh, well, you got to let them be homeowners. The argument was, oh, well, if you don't let low-income people become homeowners, they'll never build up equity, except the equity blew up in
except
their face.
Except when they lost trillions of dollars of equity. Absolutely. Over the past
What I'd like to do for low-income people is to make it easier for them to save, make it easier for them to do the kind of savings that they do. Home should be a good place to live. We shouldn't confuse that with being your major investment source.
Right. So let me ask you, now, you're obviously still incredibly engaged in this type of policy talk, and you speak of it as it being we must fight for this. I mean, what's next? I mean,
well, citizens fight. I mean, you certainly aren't suggesting that only elected officials fight.
No, I agree. But I have to tell you that you, as far as your average citizen goes, you seem to be very engaged.
I do, but wait a minute. We're here at NetRoots. This is not the Net Loungers. These are the answer is I'm going to be writing a book in which I make the case for government. I am, I think a lot of people on the left make the mistake of joining in the government bashing and then saying, okay, well, government's no good, but we're going to try and expand this program and that program. You can't do that. I think that's, you know, you can't talk about how government is lousy and then be surprised when they're suspicious of a health care program that is more government. I'm making speeches.
In other words, things like sort of Bill Clinton when he came into office and said that, you know, we're going to...
Absolutely right, and I want to write this in the book. When he said the era of big government is over, it was a terrible thing to say. For one thing, I asked one of his staff, when was that era of big government? I must have slept through it. I don't remember an era of big government. But this notion that government... And people are hypocritical. Big government's bad. What are they doing now? What do the conservative Republicans want to get an immigration bill through? Bigger government. They want to hire more agents. They want to build more fences. They want bigger government. Well, I think they get a little carried away with that, but that's relevant. I was really disappointed when Clinton said that, and I think Clinton was an example of that. Yes, he wanted to expand government in some specific areas, but he cut across his own tracks by being critical of government in general, and it's that suspicion of government in general that interferes when you try and improve it in the particular.
Are there any politicians out there now that you see that are making the case for government, rhetorically at least,
well,
that you think have a big future in...
Jerry Brown. I'm a great admirer now of Jerry Brown having gotten that tax thing through.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's afraid of taxes. I would get asked, well, how come you're not pushing for more of a tax cut? My answer was, in my district, because I never saw a tax cut put out a fire. There are things that we have to do. I think he's doing that. I think many of the... Democratic leadership people are doing that. I think Nancy Pelosi has been working on that. George Miller, we're here in the Bay Area. There are people who have taken that, I think, in a constructive way.
Congressman Barney Frank, thank you so much for joining
me. My pleasure.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Continuing our coverage at NetRoots Nation, I'm Sam Seder, and with me now is Shannon Moore. We're at NetRoots Nation 2013. Shannon, we spoke at NetRoots 2012, and at that time, you were telling me the fight that was going on in Alaska at Pebble Bay.
Pebble Mine.
Pebble Mine.
Bristol Bay.
In Bristol Bay. In Alaska, you, of course, are... the premier liberal talk radio host in Alaska.
I think I'm the only liberal talk host in Alaska.
Well, I rest my case. I rest my case.
Absolutely. This fight to protect salmon in Bristol Bay has been going on for almost a decade now, and it's got a huge amount of bipartisan support. But, you know, it's sort of the corporates versus the, say, the salmon folks. And when I talked to you last year, we were working really hard to try to make this more of a national story, and you certainly helped with that. The president with the EPA decided they would do a water assessment, right, a watershed assessment of this mine that has been proposed in Alaska.
And what are they going to be mining?
It's copper and gold primarily. Okay. It's called the Pebble Mine. It's at the headwaters of the last and largest wild sockeye salmon stream water system. So over 50% of the nation's seafood comes out of this bay. I mean, it's a food security issue. There's all sorts of issues with it. So we were, you know, we've been trying to make this a national issue. And the president, after being asked by several native groups in Alaska, they decided to do a watershed assessment. It's come out, and it said basically, even if everything went perfectly, this is what the EPA said, even if everything went perfectly, it would damage the salmon industry. So right now we're waiting.
That sounds like it has a high percentage of damaging the salmon industry.
So what's happening right now is it's become more of a national story, of course. All kinds of Washington Post has written about it. All the guys from Deadliest Catch have weighed in. I mean, it's becoming this more national story finally, because the president has about 30 more days until the EPA is going to rule on this. The Koch brothers and the Chamber of Commerce are now throwing tremendous amount of money and influence trying to beat us back, because they do not want the federal government to be able to say no to a project, any project. They don't give a rat's ass about salmon or mining or native people or indigenous folks or anything else. For them, it's just that power situation.
You know what's stunning is that how many stories where we hear this the same refrain over and over again about the Koch brothers and the Chamber of Commerce, mm-hmm. who are actively engaging in this. You know, and there are times, I think, where there's a perception by the audience and by others just in general that when you talk of the Koch brothers, when you talk about the Chamber of Commerce, there's some type of hyperbole involved in this. And but the reality is that
right.
these guys just put themselves. They are the driving force between things behind things that you just most people find abominable.
Well, you know, a year and a half ago, I met with two of the attorneys for the National Chamber of Commerce. They came to Alaska. And I said, look, can I just meet with you? I want to explain to you about this mine. I want to tell you what it is to have been born and raised in Alaska and to live off of this land and what this means, you know, for not just myself, but for so many people. So they met with me at this, you know, as fancy a restaurant as we have in Alaska. And I went through this whole thing with them explaining, you know, the situation with mine there and the situation with the companies and the back record on these corporations that aren't even American corporations. They can pick up and leave Superfund sites. And I explained this. And towards the end of this, I mean, we're drinking some pretty nice wine. Towards the end of this, this attorney looks at me and he says, honey, we don't care about the salmon. We don't care about your little Eskimos. We don't care about the mine, any of it. What we care about is the precedent this sets. You are totally right about all this warm, fuzzy stuff, but we don't care.
And I
was just like, how can you not care? You know, and it was like, oh, this is about corporate ability to maneuver in this country and not have a check system and to not have the accountability and to be able to privatize all the profits that they would with this mine. It's less than 3% that they would pay in corporate taxes to the state of Alaska for this, right? So they privatize the profits. And then they socialize this risk
right.
to a group of people who have lived in this country for 10,000 years eating this food source.
But I think, you know, that is a genuinely amazing story. And I think it's also very instructive because people sit back and they just wonder how it's possible that they can do this. And you have to see it from their perspective. For them, they do not care. Mm-hmm. This is simply about, and it's not just simply about winning. It is simply about making sure that the path is clear for other projects down the road,
right.
that the implications of this one on their bottom line may be minimal. It may be, you know, somewhere between significant and insignificant. But what's really relevant is that if this door shuts here, it sets a precedent that the EPA can do this, that the EPA should be doing this, that people power can function. This is one of those instances where this is part of a much larger project for them in some mm-hmm. respects.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with the specifics of this project at all.
And on some level, the flip side of this is exactly why this should be a national issue for progressives around the mm-hmm. country, because as Pebble Mine goes, so goes their river basin, their forest that they are next to, their beach, whatever it is.
Well, when you have this water system of Bristol Bay that produces over half of the nation's seafood, I mean, it's a food source
right.
in this. You have these pristine waters. There are no hatcheries. This is a completely natural, sustainable food source that is, I mean, that's moving. It does have the mercury issues that other fish does. It's this brilliant thing. It's in this land that hasn't had this happen. The indigenous people are begging for protection, right? We've got thousands and thousands of jobs, fishing jobs, more fishing jobs relying on it than mining jobs would be created. If we can't stop this one, there is nowhere in the country that they're going to say no.
Tell me what happens next.
Right now, there's still public comment coming into the EPA. And so SaveBristolBay.org, people can go there and you know, read more about it, make themselves aware of it. If they want to weigh in with the EPA, that would be fantastic.
SaveBristolBay.org.
Yes. And there's, you know, for the Facebook pages and all that. On Twitter, the hashtag's NoPebble, and I'm on there all the time. But to be aware of that. But I think what you said that was so crucial is this is a national story. This, even if you don't like salmon, if they can't say no to this. And the 404C, that part of the Clean Water Act, it's the emergency brake in the vehicle of development, right?
Right.
And for people to say, oh, well, you don't like development or whatever, it's like saying you don't like getting in a car if you said, okay, no seat belts, no emergency brakes, I'm not getting in that car, and they're like, you hate transportation. Well, I mean, this is like catastrophic scale.
The conversation you had with these attorneys is mm-hmm. is really should be the big red flag for anyone else in the country, because if they see this as precedent setting, the precedent can be set one of two ways.
Right.
One is that when even in the best case scenario, it's going to be problematic for a food supply and for the environment, that if that isn't enough
right.
to stop this private enterprise by the Koch brothers and the Chamber of Commerce and their accrual of private profits, if that's not enough, it's ball game over for everyone else.
Right. And so, you know, we'll hopefully the president will have the resolve to like use this in this moment.
And I think, is this a presidential decision, or is this an EPA decision, or is this one of those decisions that the EPA ostensibly is going to make, but the president may Bigfoot in some
way? Yeah, I think the White House has definitely been involved in this decision. Lisa Jackson, of course, on her way out, and we had uh-huh. talked to her. We'd been working on this. You know, everybody from Sandra Day O'Connor to Ted Nugent is like against this mine. It's like, there's wow. all these people who are like, you know, I want to go out to that area and shoot brown bear. I mean, it's like
right.
there's all kinds of different consumption reasons. But, no, this is great that you've – every year that I've been here, you've been willing to, like, talk about this issue.
It's an important issue. And you have really, I think, made it very explicit as to why. Shannon Moore, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Sam.